are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 3rd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, activist, author, documentary filmmaker Astra Taylor on her new book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. Also on the program today, 12 victims and shooter dead, the latest mass shooting. DOJ and FTC looking at Google over antitrust issues. Poll shows impeachment rising as the third most powerful Democrat in Congress. Clyburn says impeachment is now inevitable. Meanwhile, Trump in the UK, being Trump in the UK. And new report, the Affordable Care Act helped to reduce racial disparities, particularly in cancer treatments. Democratic hopefuls in California focus on Biden, while some abandon small donors. And the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service reports that the Trump tax cuts flopped, unless you are already super rich. Time to take back that Arthur Laffer Medal of Freedom. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It is another week. We are already in June. Sort of shocking that we are here. Just a reminder for what we've got coming up in this month. We have at least two Democratic debates. Well, no, two Democratic debates. They'll be back to back. The first half of the 22 candidates or 25 or 27, 35 candidates will go up on one night and then the other half on the other night. Of course, not everyone will make those two debates. And it's unclear to me at this point, and I'm not sure if it's public even, it will be determined who's on what stage. I believe that's going to be very, very important in terms of impacting this race. There was a report out. Theodore Johnson was writing about this from the Brennan Center in the Washington Post. A lot of Joe Biden's support from African Americans is basically comes down to a function that they believe he can win. And African Americans, black people, have a very, very strong interest in getting rid of Donald Trump in a way that other people may. Well, I don't know how you compare that, but the sense of potential for backsliding on issues of race and civil rights is a major factor in the determination as to whether they will support Joe Biden, largely just as a function of whether he can win. There are obviously other attributes, but this is a prominent one. And it's not inconsistent with what we've seen in the past. And the support for Barack Obama in the black community was very, very low until he won in Iowa in 2007. And that's when you started to see Clinton's support, I wouldn't say crater, but certainly diminish, and people going to Obama when there was a sense that he could win. So one of the things that I think is going to be is going to be play a huge role with Joe Biden is either the emergence of someone else who can be seen as winning as easily as Joe Biden, or Joe Biden being seen to be less invincible. And one of those things is going to be, I think, momentum coming out of the debates and really what happens in Iowa and New Hampshire, those first two states. So we shall see. Also, I just want to get to just some two corrections and a little one other thing here. One is, yesterday we headlined a story that a North Korean, a senior North Korean official who was ostensibly the envoy to the U.S. talks, was killed, and that there was some type of purge. There are now reports saying that that purge was not accurately reported, that maybe it didn't happen at all. It's unclear. But certainly, it turned out, I don't know if that was a hoax or what the deal was, or if there were other people who may have been purged and not. There was talk that there were multiple people purged, but it is clear that Kim Jong-chol, who was Mike Pompeo's counterpart with the United States, was not purged. He's been showing up in public. At the time, I have to say kudos to Brendan, because when Brendan first heard that story, he said, this is weird. Why would Un admit that he screwed up in any way by taking it out, even if it was to blame other people? So let that correction stand. Also, we played a clip on Friday, I think it was on Friday, of a reporter from Inside Edition questioning a pastor on the purchase of whose plane was it? Was it
Tyler Perry's?
Tyler Perry's plane, and why he had to buy it, because it was just Tyler Perry made it so cheap.
You made it so cheap.
I had to buy it. I mean, I had to. We didn't. We neglected to mention the name of the reporter. It was Lisa Guerrero. She is a reporter with Inside Edition. Does apparently a lot of work like that, and so. If you have kudos for that interview, make sure that you reach out to her. We've put a link in yesterday's YouTube thing, and maybe we should put that in today as well to her Twitter feed.
I'm going to say it right now. Kudos for that interview.
There you go. I'll probably get into this a little bit later, but I got some response. And I'm curious what people think about this, that I wasn't actually hard enough on Steven Crowder for his blatant homophobia and his...
I'll take some of the rap. I didn't know that he was a AIDS crisis denialist. He has multiple videos of, like, the AIDS crisis was, like, that it affected gay people so bad is basically exaggerated.
I didn't know that at all either.
Yeah.
I mean, here's
that's
the thing.
That's like some Holocaust denial level shit right there.
And I don't want to spend too much time on this right now, because we've got to get to our guest, but... just briefly, you know, when I look at that, I see somebody doing something similar to what I'm doing, just, you know, without the content, but just the sort of the shell, the structure. And I was just like sort of flabbergasted, like, how does an adult actually do this in 2019? How does like an adult person do this and do it in public as a job? And I think on some level, like, I was just, because I don't think the guy from Vox, who Crowder is basically, I don't know, say gay bashing, but, gay, I mean, sort of, right? I mean, at least rhetorically, he doesn't care about Steven Crowder. And I mean, he's a fully grown adult and, you know, but. The thing that I started to think about, and based on some criticism that I got, Crowder is clearly aiming his show at kids. And by kids, I mean like teens, right? And I mean, I think that that's become much more clear to me. He is exploiting their ignorance and their youth and whatnot. That's why he can go and debate college students, and it doesn't make it look, you know, people don't, his audience doesn't look at him like this. And it's also probably on some reason why they have the whole cigar and sophisticated liquor thing, because frankly, as a 12 or 13 year old boy, I can tell you, like, that looks like what an adult does.
Man babies.
Yes.
Yeah. And college students look like grownups.
Right. Exactly. And,
do you remember the campaign we were going to do with you?
Well, wait, let me just get through this. And so, but the thing that is really, when you become aware of that, he is going on, and not only, you know, I can't remember the report, and certainly writings, the things like Will and Grace, that sitcom, which I never watched really, but I didn't watch any of them, frankly. But the implications of that, if you're a 12-year-old boy living in, you know, in some rural area or some parts of the country where gay people had not been accepted, you know, during that era. We're huge in terms of what it's saying, that, like, look, regardless of what you're going through now, that in society at large, you will be accepted. And literally Crowder's doing the opposite. And it's, I don't know if Crowder is aware of this, but, teen suicide rates for kids who are gay, for kids who are transgender or feel that they, you know, are not living they are not the gender they were born with or assigned to, is real. Teen suicide rates, I mean, they're high, and it's a real phenomenon. And to mainstream and legitimize and frankly encourage that type of gay bashing, you know, it should never have been acceptable, but particularly, you know, now when there is, like, you know, we are hopefully several decades away, multiple decades away from some measure of enlightenment, is really reprehensible. I mean, it's just disgusting. And so I didn't mean to soft pedal that, and maybe we can talk more about it in the second half of the program. But it really is gross, but it's beyond gross. It's horrific in many ways, and I found it so hard to absorb in this day and age that you would do a show that, you know, a staple of which is the just the out-and-out gay bashing is pretty stunning.
I mean, the producer's name is not Gay Jared.
I know. Like, it's just
everywhere
so
in the
juvenile.
Show. It's crazy.
But it's the point I guess I'm making is, like, to me, it just struck me as so juvenile. But then I was like, but it's worse than juvenile, because he's not a juvenile. And he is a role model for juveniles. And that's what makes it so horrific.
Hey, man, you got to meet those 14-year-old boys where they are.
Yeah, I guess so. You could probably do it with video games. Folks, you may think that you don't need life insurance yet, but if you have loved ones who depend on you, you need to have a plan. I certainly never thought about life insurance until my kids were born. My daughter was born. I ended up getting some term life insurance that's got her covered well past. I went further than college for her because I anticipated a second child. Didn't realize it'd be such a gap. But I still got him under the wire. So he's covered through college, if that's what he wants to do. But it's intimidating if you've never even contemplated. Thankfully, Ethos makes doing the responsible thing easy. With Ethos, you can get covered in like 10 minutes. You can even sign up right from your phone. There's no pesky paperwork, no pushy salespeople. You just choose a policy that fits your needs. You don't waste time deciphering the fine print, because Ethos treats you like a person, not a risk. They work with you to make sure you have the right policy for your lifestyle and your budget. They have a dedicated customer support team that's right here in the United States. and they help with any questions you might have. Visit ethoslife.com. Click on Check My Price to get started on the quick online application. You can insure your life today by going to ethoslife.com/majority to apply online. Insuring your life and providing your family with financial security has never been easier. That's ethos, E-T-H-O-S, life.com/majority, and you're 10 minutes away from your estimated rate. Make sure your family's future is safe no matter what. That's ethoslife.com/majority. Also, there's many times, particularly when I'm not with the children, where I forget to eat dinner, I don't want to go out, boom, whatever it is. You realize 8 a.m., you need a breakfast burrito. You need some red wine, 4 p.m., sometimes maybe in the middle of the afternoon, depending on what's going on. Kids are driving you crazy. Ibuprofen or whatever it is at in the morning or at night. You got a headache, Michael? Maybe you like peppermint.
Maybe some peppermint essential oil.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Well, Postmates it. Postmates is your personal food delivery, grocery delivery, whatever kind of delivery service all year round. No more trips to the store. Anything you're craving, Postmates can deliver within the hour, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. I don't know how they do this. The largest on-demand network in the U.S., they offer delivery from all the restaurants, grocery, convenience stores, traditional retailers you could possibly need. Simply download the app for iOS or Android for free. Browse local restaurants and businesses and track your delivery in real time. And for a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days when you use the code REPORT. That's the code REPORT for $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Try it out, folks. This is the time to do it. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. Download Postmates and save with the code REPORT. Lastly, we don't all have the opportunity to go to a silent retreat for a week.
But some of us need it.
Some of us need it, but we don't all have that luxury. Well, the World Health Organization's named the health epidemic of the 21st century. Do you know what it is?
I'm going to guess that it is stress.
Yes, exactly. Tremendous amount of stress in our lives every day. Michael's super calm, but that's why we're partnering with Calm. It's the number one rated app for meditation. When you meditate, your brain chemistry changes. Michael came in here. He's like completely, almost too chill.
He's floating.
Yeah,
like
he's floating around.
Well, we had the very opposite of a silent retreat.
Yeah,
last
exactly.
Week.
Yeah, exactly.
You guys, don't worry. As soon as I saw the DiGiorno tweet, I was back.
Now, Michael, you probably know this because they probably told you, but meditation has been shown to slow down the release of stress chemicals into your bloodstream.
Indeed.
Like cortisol and adrenaline.
Yes.
Gives you much needed relief. With Calm, you'll discover a whole library of simple guided meditations on themes like anxiety, creativity, and focus. They even have other resources to help you relax, like sleep stories. That's what I like. Music and more. I found those sleep stories are pretty good. I can't do the one with the, the lavender fields, but anything else is good.
You'll get a psychosomatic reaction.
Exactly. Good night, ha-choo. So if you're stressed, take a deep breath and get Calm. Right now, Majority Report listeners get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/majority. That's Calm, calm.com/majority. 40 million people have downloaded Calm. Find out why at calm.com/majority. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Astra Taylor about her book, Democracy May Not Exist, but we'll miss it when it's gone. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program activist, author, documentary filmmaker. Latest film is What is Democracy? Out with Zeitgeist Films. And the book, the companion book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. Astra Taylor, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
This is low-hanging fruit in terms of a question, but I guess I have to ask, what is democracy?
Oh my God, you got me. No, I mean, what is democracy? It's interesting to flash back to when I first started filming the documentary and imagine myself being put in the position of the people I stopped on the street. You know, what would have been my answer then?
When did you start shooting the documentary?
So I wrote the proposal for it all the way back in 2013 and got the green light and started filming in 2015. So, now I would say democracy is the rule of the people, the demos of democracy. The demos have kratos, which is, power. To go back to the ancient Greek, and of course the Greeks didn't invent the process of democracy, but they gave us that word. And I think it's a powerful word, this idea that the people rule. I also like Aristotle's definition, which is democracy is ruled by the poor, because the poor are always more numerous than the rich, right? And so if we're talking about the majority making decisions, then it's not rich people, it's not oligarchy. So that's a nice way of just drawing a line between what democracy should be in the situation we have today.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience at Occupy, because I would imagine on some level the idea of this, if not necessarily inspired out of Occupy, but was at least informed in your experience there. Talk to us about that, because it seems to me that, well, I just start with that, and then I just want to talk about, why Occupy happened when it happened.
Yeah, I mean, Occupy Wall Street, so fall of 2011, it was a response to a movement around the world calling for real democracy. So, it was inspired by the Arab Spring, and there was the movement of the squares in Europe and in places like Greece and Spain and well beyond. And so I got involved in the Occupy movement. In fact, I co-founded a union for debtors called the Debt Collective that is still active, and I recommend people check it out. The idea is to use debt as a form of economic leverage to change our financial system. But that, Occupy was a movement that I think rightfully criticizing the status quo at that moment, right? The banks had gotten bailed out. The people had gotten sold out. The system we have is not democratic. It put the issue of class front and center, the 1% versus the 99%. So I think Occupy was a real game changer in many ways. And yet it was sort of in its DNA committed to a vision of democracy that was direct as opposed to representative. And this in the beginning was really beautiful because you'd have these mass general assemblies sort of at dusk and, people were using the human microphone and it was very powerful, but it was not a functional mode of running the movement, let alone running the whole society. So I think what Occupy, did for me was to go, okay, well, hold on. We're talking about democracy, but what do we mean? We know what we're against. We're against the concentration of wealth. We're against the exploitation of the environment. We're against the idea in Citizens United that, money is speech. But what do we mean by the word? And I realized how little we had to fall back on in terms of basic political theory and philosophy. I mean, most people had a kind of like middle school, high school operating, level of understanding of sort of civics, right? And so it threw me back on this question, what do we mean by democracy? What do we want? That led me to make this film and to write the companion book.
We talk about it as being, a democracy as being ruled by the people. My experience, I guess my sense of what was happening at Occupy at the time was that, all of these type of these type of events or, not events, but just sort of like a phenomenon have like a half-life. And on some level that half-life, I think was sped up, frankly, by Michael Bloomberg and maybe some, coordination across the country of tactics. But be that as it may, part of the problem was, on some level, was sort of like, it was very difficult to deal. I mean, I remember going down there and having friends tell me, like, we're having real problem with this committee or that committee because it's being dominated by two or three people, which was ironic, right? That yeah. It's that democratic, but there ends up being people who sort of, I don't know, take more of the slice of democracy in that moment, you know, and there's just a different type of currency. Go ahead.
No, I like your phrase, the half-life. I mean, to me, I went down to Occupy, you know, in the first day and hung around those early weeks. And I thought, okay, this is going to burn itself out, right? This has a sort of inner clock that's going to reach its end. So I'm very surprised that we're talking about it today, you know, years after the fact. But there was something in that commitment to direct democracy and to democracy by consensus. There was a fatal flaw, which you just put your finger on, which is when you're operating by consensus, then a small number of people can veto. They have incredible veto power. And so what seems like it's going to be, you know, utopian and democratic actually turns into its opposite, because it becomes a sort of dictatorship of the grumpy few, or maybe people who are there to derail things purposefully. So, you know, what I took away from that, so the book is set up as an investigation into the contradictions or tensions that I think are at the heart of democracy. And, you know, so the entire book is very much attuned to the question of economics, the fact that we do, you know, we live in a situation with intense concentration of wealth and attention to the fact that capitalism is, I would say, inherently undemocratic in the sense that it concentrates wealth, it concentrates power, it concentrates ownership, right? So then how can you have people ruling themselves as equals? But with that, you know, so that's a sort of thread through the whole book, but each chapter is about a paradox. So one of them is the tension between consensus and conflict, right? Like, when do we aim for a total agreement in a group? Or when do we just say, okay, this is, our differences are irreconcilable and we're going to have to fight it out? There's not a one size fits all answer for every situation. So the book looks at these things, these tensions that make democracy just really difficult to actually enact. So we can give a simple definition, democracy is the people rule, but how we actually do that requires a whole robust system of supports. It requires constant reevaluation and reassessment. And we have to hold these things in balance. Like, when do we aim to all agree and have a unanimous decision? And when do we just say, okay, that's not going to happen, we're going to have to use adversarial procedures to make it through?
Why do you think, I mean, the fact that Occupy happened at that time, right? That there was like a, I mean, it sort of felt, I mean, it was certainly in the air. I mean, I remember, you know, just in 2010 trying to pitch people on the idea right now is sort of insider, outsider, like establishment, non-establishment, you know, that there was a sense of like so many people had been left out of even the supposed solution to this calamity, and mostly people who were responsible for it, were able to sort of like, they were the first people to turn around and go, oh, I've got the fix for this. But it seemed like there was a lag time. What do you think accounts for that timing? And there was a lot of things happening in that fall. Was it that people were getting inspired by each other or what?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lag time. When I hear you say there was a lag time, I'm thinking there's a lag time in terms of responding to the financial crisis. I mean, I think we're still living in the aftermath of 2008, 2009. And so for me, you know, Occupy was, on the one hand, it was like totally necessary in the sense that in those years immediately after the banking sector implodes, exactly as you say, the people there to put it back together again are the people responsible for it, and they're getting these massive bonuses. And then the folks agitating in the streets are the Tea Party, right? And that just was so ridiculous, egregious. And so, you know, people had been feeling the squeeze. They'd been feeling, you know, an economic pinch, right? We had been... we all know that since the 70s, you know, wages have stagnated, you know, we've been covering up for That stagnation with, you know, easy access to credit. So people were deeply indebted. And so I think on some level, it's like, okay, something like Occupy had to happen. But I think it needed that global context of all these other movements in order to sort of motivate people to take this step that seemed kind of ridiculous, which is like, okay, let's all go hang out in a park, which, you know, it's not a strategy that can transform the system, but was a strategy that got attention. And I think did, you know, it's kind of a cliche to say it, but change the conversation. I think the question is, you know, what people need to do once that conversation has shifted, right? So that's sort of the problem of democracy that we're in now, which is how do you actually build power for the people? How do you transform democracy? And, you know, what I say in the introduction of the book is, you know, the challenge of the, you know, late 19th and 20th centuries were to the challenge of democracy was extending the franchise, enfranchising all of these people, all these populations who had been excluded by formal democracy. I think the challenge for our time is extending democracy beyond that limited political sphere into other arenas of our lives, democratizing the economy above all. And, you know, that is a strategic challenge that, you know, something like Occupy was pointing towards the need for that, but didn't have the tactics or the strategy to actually do it.
Yeah. Do you think I want to move forward from this too, because I just the whole phenomenon I think is interesting. Do you think that there is a set of strategy and tactics out there that Occupy could have grown into or, you know, had adopted that would have had a different historical arc? I mean, I've asked myself this many, many times, particularly, mm-hmm. Or was that simply like that had to happen? It had to end. And then you have people like yourself who go out into the debt collective, but it also turned into sort of like, I think you could find a lot of people who are involved in Occupy in DSA groups around the country. Yeah. Bernie Sanders, I think 2016 campaign doesn't happen if it was not for what Occupy injected into the bloodstream. I mean, I think there's a myriad of things like that where sort of the fallout creates all different types of movements, as it were. Or do you think there was like a set of strategies at one point that that could have been followed? That could have. I mean, I think the committee on that gave feedback on the 21st century Glass-Steagall. People consider that document on what to do with the banks to be the most comprehensive and prepared document that came in, period, from anywhere. Yeah. How would you answer that question?
I basically agree with your summary of that it kind of had to go the way it did, because, you know, I think there were lots of us who were involved in Occupy essentially not because we totally agreed with its anarchist tactics, but because it was the thing addressing the economic crisis, right? So, you know, you don't get to just pull the perfect movement out of your purse, right? You have to go where the people are. I, you know, at the time wished there was a kind of speedier evolution, and I think there were these signs. The Occupy the SEC group, who did the Volcker letter, I think that's what you're referring to. You know, other groups that were focused on foreclosures and home evictions, I thought those were really promising. But there was definitely a resistance to making demands of the state, to like collaborating with unions. And so I think there's a big shift right now, and you put your finger on it. The people who have gone into the Bernie campaign, who've gone into DSA, in a way, you know, the work we're doing with the debt collective, are saying, okay, we have to make demands. We have to make demands of the state. We have to make demands of our financial institutions. You know, we have to not just be ungovernable, but actually to try to govern, to remake the machine that's running over all of us, right? To not only just be the resistance, right? But to try to be a real force in this world. And you know, it's a tough process because the left was so obliterated. I mean, that's why I was sympathetic to Occupy. There weren't organizations for young people to join, to learn how to do the hard work of organizing. You know, unions are a weak in this country, right? So people don't have that tradition to fall back on. So I'm happy that, you know, we are that protest energy hasn't totally dissipated, and that it does seem like people are learning from the sort of problems of Occupy. And hopefully, you know, the thing is now we'll just have new problems to contend with, because they never go away.
All right. One last question about Occupy, just because I'm sort of fascinated. But like, when I think back in 2011, and we actually took the show down there, I think on the first Monday, maybe, which was after the weekend, and maybe it was raining, or maybe it was the first Friday, and we couldn't do it because it was raining. But we were back down there, and as far as I can tell, even then, which is only now 8 years ago, there was not a lot of talk necessarily. I mean, there was some talk of anarchists there a little bit, yeah, but not hugely. And there was not even a lot of talk about like socialists, just in terms of socialism and how it has become an identifier that primary candidates in the Democratic primary 8 years later are like afraid of almost saying like, I'm not socialist. Like, you know, like that's a contentious thing to say now. What was your sense of that being there? I mean, I think you were there a lot more than I was during that time, just physically, but do you think that opened the door? I mean, I feel like that time was like a hinge, you know, and maybe it was a generational thing, or I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say two things on that, because I think it definitely did open the door. When I think back to the, you know, what could have happened sort of thought experiment of Occupy, to me, the failure isn't with the occupiers, who, again, were stepping into this void, right? Void of the left, and doing what they could. They had images of people protesting in the streets, so they protested in the streets, you know. To me, it was a failure of the establishment to recognize what was going on in that moment and respond to it with force and conviction, right? Because what you saw at Occupy was exactly what you just said, which is, you know, these people were not like diehard anarchists or necessarily always people with a sort of coherent left-wing ideology. They were people whose houses had been foreclosed on, you know, who were drowning in medical debt because some tragedy had befallen their family, who had gone to school like they'd been told to do their whole lives and are weighted down with unpayable student loans. I mean, this was a massive indication of the discontent that we're still dealing with today, right? So to me, I think, you know, the problem wasn't with the movement itself. It's the fact that the people with power just actually couldn't metabolize it, you know, and just wanted to continue to stick their heads in the sand. I think that I never would have guessed that democratic socialism would become words that were sayable in the mainstream the way that they are now. I think there were definitely individuals there who were, you know, identified as socialists or democratic socialists. I mean, you know, but what I think we could not have foreseen is that that would actually catch on. I think the Bernie campaign is absolutely part of that. I think the left can't take all the credit for the rise of socialism, because one thing is, you know, part of it is just the abject failure of capitalism to provide for people's basic needs, right? So, so when you have a generation that is in debt for their education, that can't find stable employment, that doesn't think they're ever going to be able to retire, that sees a climate catastrophe on their horizon, they're going to start doubting the system that they've been told is the be-all and end-all of, you know, human capacity. So I think part of the credit goes to the failure of capitalism, and also to the fact that the right has branded just basic social services as socialism, right? So we're in a point where, you know, if Fox News is going to go around and say, you know, hey, being able to go to a doctor is socialism, then it starts to sound pretty good. Right. So I think all these factors are playing in, and I think the left actually needs to catch up and seize this moment. We can't actually take too much. We shouldn't take all the credit for it. It's like what there is there's sort of shift. There's an opening. We're still in that hinge moment, as you described it. And can we actually organize it? And this goes back to, know, this is part of why I was thinking through these issues in my book and my film, because I think this is a moment where, you know, in crises have always led to a kind of renaissance of thinking. And this is, happens all throughout political philosophy, where there's some sort of emergency or civil war or conflict, and new ideas come about. And we're kind of in that moment now where, because there was this massive financial crisis and the rise of the right, I think people are going, they're questioning things, they're questioning everything. And I think we need to nurture that questioning instead of going into an easy nostalgia, whether it's the nostalgia of the right, who wants to make America great again, or the nostalgia of the sort of centrist democratic establishment who just wants to make it 2015 again.
Moving forward, at least through your book, to a certain extent, I'm sort of interested in this sort of and you set up these different dynamics, like you said, the tension between expertise and mass opinion, and you write about the anti-tax revolt in California, which ended up with Proposition 13, and then, you know, as a kid, I remember when this was adopted by Massachusetts, like 3 or 4 years later, and just 1 year went to school and half the stuff was gone. Like, there was no more sports teams. There was no more, art class. And in California in particular, there's been, you know, certainly through like the 80s and the 90s, there was this sort of, you know, populism, I guess, right? Like that, but it was not, I don't know if it was necessary. It was driven by non-democratic forces, it seems to me. But where do you get that sort of, like, talk a little bit about that tension between the sort of the expertise and the sort of mass opinion, which can be manipulable, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of those tensions, again, we can't resolve. I mean, one reason critics have always feared democracy, sort of elite critics, is that democracy, you know, there's no barrier to entry. It's not like you have to have a democracy degree and then you get to participate. So I think democracy does always have this risk, right, that people will get swept up, and the old idea of people having unruly passions and not being virtuous and you know, that democracy will sort of self-destruct. I mean, Plato, in his famous text, The Republic, warns that democracy always devolves into tyranny. What I highlight in the film and the book is that he says that the conditions for that devolution are oligarchy, or the intense concentration of wealth. And what happens is, you know, the city splits in two, and it's the rich versus the poor. And that's what creates conditions for these plutocrats or these elites to create these sort of faux populist moments, right, that we're kind of living through now. So, I mean, I think we have to, in what I'm trying to do with the question of the debate, the tension between experts and sort of mass opinion, is to say that we have to work to create a philosophical public, right? And the risk of that argument is that there's almost this, like, cliche idea that education is what will save us. Often, if that's what I noticed going around with the film, when you'd say, okay, how can we fix democracy? People would say, education. And I try to be a bit more critical in the text and say, education for what, right? What is the curriculum people are being taught? Whose interests are being served? There's a very moving scene in the documentary, which I should say that people can stream. It's streaming on iTunes and Amazon and on Canopy, which is a service most libraries have. But where I interview these kids from an inner city school in Miami, they're like 12 or 13. And essentially, you realize that what the curriculum that they're getting, the democratic curriculum they're being taught, is one of basically being told not to engage democratically. So they recount the story where they're asking for the school to heat up their food. They want their lunches to be warm, and they're just completely crushed by the teachers. And so, you know, this one kid says very movingly, like, yeah, they talk about democracy, but they talk about sort of like government. They don't talk about us actually being able to have a voice in the school, or us having power. So, you know, I think we need to sort of challenge the cliche that education is what will solve all of our problems. On the Prop 13 thing, I think, you know, I write about that at length because it's such an interesting example of effective activism. And the left doesn't pay attention. I don't think we pay attention enough to right-wing movements. And I look at it because, you know, it began as a genuine revolt in California where people were having trouble paying their property taxes. And so some people on fixed income, older people who had bought their houses long ago, started to lose them. And what happened is this sort of charlatan guy was able to mobilize around that genuine problem and yoke it to a sort of anti-tax ideology. And then Ronald Reagan, who's, you know, would incorporate this into his run for president. And it was sort of a foundational conservative move and put anti-taxes actually on the national agenda. And why I admire the right as much as I disagree with their politics is that they understood that they shouldn't just refuse. They weren't just like, okay, we're going to refuse to pay our taxes. What they did was they remade the rules through a referendum, right? And they remade the modes of governing. And I think that's the step the left needs to look towards, to not just say, again, you know, resistance or we'll be ungovernable or we'll put our bodies in the way of the gears of the machine, but how can we actually tackle those structures of power? How can we actually remake the system so that it's more equitable and more democratic? And so it's actually in the chapter that's on the distinction between spontaneity and structure. Like, yes, democracy needs the spontaneous revolts and these moments of protest, like Occupy or you know, where we're in the streets, but we also need to structure our system to make it have outcomes that we want.
But that's sort of a central dilemma, isn't it? I mean, because what happened with Prop 13 was also very similar to what happened was basically the Tea Party movement in many respects, right? Yeah. I mean, it starts with this sort of like notion of like, we're not going to bail out the homeowners because and sort of this energy that's out there, right? This maybe what is a legitimate anger is just subtly channeled. But the subtle channeling happens because there's someone with a tremendous amount of money who's basically like looking at this fertile, you know, piece of property and just sort of saying like, I'm going to seed over there and I'm going to seed over there. And then stuff grows there as opposed to where they don't seed with money. And there's no one on the left. There's not an analog on the left for that. Where, like, okay, we have all this energy. We're going to make it completely, you know, it's going to be decentralized, the decision-making on as to, you know, that structure. It seems to me that money, what it ends up doing is it creates a structure without imposing one, and it allows a sort of central authority to sort of create that without it make it seem like it is being created, because it's just a matter of like, oh, well, people are going to, you know, migrate to where the resources are. And that's where things are going to bloom, you know, the areas that are getting watered, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, both of those things, you know, those movements are definitely related, the tax revolts of the late 70s and 80s and the Tea Party. And it's true, like, you know, we can't dismiss both of them as totally just nothing but AstroTurf. There was a genuine, a genuine component. And then you're absolutely right. Institutionalized money, conservative think tanks and operatives were able to latch on and take those that discontent and harness it to their goals, which is to dismantle the state. And you know, they got a big return on investment, right? Because if you decimate taxes, that's money in your pocket. And so I think the left has more difficult conditions to grapple with on two fronts. One, we don't get that same return on investment, right? Because we're not companies just looking to lower our bills and get more money into our coffers. But I think we are trying to push the state to actually deliver social services. And so the right is just, you know, gets to be nihilistic because they just want the state to shrink down to, you know, to the point they can drown it in the bathtub, whereas we want the state to actually do good. So, you know, we have a tougher road, but I do think that something like the tax revolt's instructive because there could have been different solutions offered to those homeowners in need. For example, could it have been that if you were on a fixed income, you know, the law just said, okay, your property taxes actually your property taxes hold tight, but you know, a company's property taxes are going to go up, right? Instead of treating every entity like it's the same as the law currently does. Could we have started a conversation about why our homes, the places we live, have to be speculative investments that we hope will rise in value, right? So why, you know, that is part of the pathology of the American way, is that our house is our asset. I mean, and that led to the financial crisis of 2008, right? So why not talk about homes that are actually made for their use value to live in, as opposed to being an asset that appreciates, you know, so decommodifying housing, social housing. And, you know, so the left has to take some responsibility for not speaking to people's needs and not offering solutions that, you know, might have shifted the conversation. And this is why, you know, we have to get organized. We have to do that work because, you know, it's a cliche, but it's true. It's like, yeah, they have money, but we have people. And the right has always feared that since the beginning of democracy, and they still do, which is why they're always trying to sort of rejig the rules and mitigate the power of numbers. So, you know, we have to do the hard work of democracy. It's not an easy thing. And writing this book convinced me of that even more. It's a challenge.
So how close are we to it being gone? And what is what's going to, or what could potentially replace it?
Oh, replace the system we have.
Democracy, as it were.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a democracy on some level for us now is, you know, one part aspirational, you know, multiple parts sort of like difficult to pin down. And but as you know, you know it when it's leaving, I guess.
Well, that's what I tried to get with the title, right? So the title of the book is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. To get to that, sort of to capture my own ambivalence, the fact that the system we live in is so far from what I believe a democracy is, and you know, lots of studies bear this out, right? That regular people have almost no say over the policies that right. govern us. And yet we know when it's being taken away. We know when things are moving backwards. I mean, just look at the news around abortion in the last few weeks. I mean, it's like devastating to witness. I think that I know we're in a state of emergency, and I've been talking about how we need to get organized, and I do as much organizing as I can through you know, my work with the Debt Collective and through being involved in electoral politics. But I also think we need to stop and think. Right. And to actually reflect on this word that we hear all around us that is invoked by people who are anything but democratic. And that's why, you know, I made the movie and wrote this book. It's like, what? Well, I think if we are going to have a chance of fighting for democracy, revitalizing it, evolving it, expanding it beyond the limited political sphere into these other areas of our lives, then we have to think about what the word means. What does democracy mean? And, you know, it's striking to me how few of us do that, how little time we devote to it, to this word that's everywhere. So that, I think, would be my sort of, you know, first challenge or hope for people, is to actually, you know, reflect on this concept and what do we want from it? Because that, if we don't do that, then we're not going to be able to sort of make progress and deepen and expand it and to I think have a chance of getting us out of the mess we're in.
Astra Taylor, the book is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, and the film is What Is Democracy? Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to both of those at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Going to head to the fun half in just a moment. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, not only do you support this free part of the show, but you also get extra content every day. And you'll also find, when you get on the app, have this opportunity to search the Majority Report app, which is free to everybody, but you log in as a member, you'll be able to search all the way back. You can search Zuccotti Park. You can search Occupy Wall Street. Go back and listen to those early days when me and old Matt went down to Zuccotti Park with a battery operated mixer and literally like walked around like a one man band. I had it all like hanging off of me. It was hilarious. There's some videos, I think, of it too. But I like was walking, holding a battery operated mixer, and we were broadcasting through like a phone or an iPad or something. Boy, have we upgraded, though, the technology. We have, actually. Now I could do that. It would sound broadcast quality almost. Come back to the zip here and pop it back out. But
I got to watch some of those.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was rain. And then, of course, it was like, oh, shoot, I have the wrong cable. And then there was a lot of that. But we were down there early. I think on day, I think it started on a Friday, maybe a Saturday morning, and we were there on Monday morning, but it was raining, and then we came back on Friday. Do you remember? You weren't there yet?
I wasn't there yet, no. Mm-mm.
I was there.
No, I'm not,
on the show.
I didn't work on the show yet.
Never mind.
But, folks can check that out.
Interview with Tim Pool, I'm finding.
Yes. Well, Tim Pool,
oh my God,
no, I remember it.
Was yeah. The cameraman for a guy, I can't remember his name right now, who was actually, I want to say Dennis? I can't remember who it was, who went on to do some good YouTube stuff, actually. And they had a falling out at one point, I think, when this guy realized, like, oh, Tim is odd. And but I don't know. And but at the time, Tim was just shooting the camera.
Oh yeah, Tim guest lectured at NYU course for one day that I had, which was a value for money. There.
Have you tried? I was gonna say, have you ever done like a calculation?
Yes, it was about $450 for that class session.
Oh, dude! So. Wow, on the same company that has an Abu Dhabi campus.
Hashtag get Matt's money back.
Go Violets.
That is legitimately not cool.
Also, folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off of your coffee. It is Monday. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Michael has ended his vow of silence. He is now speaking.
Beep.
So laid back.
Tomorrow, guided meditation. And
God, you're so sleepy now.
Yeah, and we're gonna try to be Indian instead of urban on the show now. As a big change in focus. On
That's
TMBF.
The binary.
Yeah,
you know, Indian does contain several large cities. Is that what you mean by urban?
Yes. No more L.A.,
we gotta send,
no more New
we gotta
York.
We got to send Michael away for another week where all he does is talk to get well, him back.
Just show me the Dave Rubin video. I couldn't even take it.
Go on a week-long riffing retreat.
Oh, my. We are...
10 a.m. Come by the rec hall. We'll be playing videos of all of the right-wing shows.
This is what we do every day. So
right,
I'm here.
That's what this is.
I'm back in the riffing life retreat of the Majority Report and TMBS. Hassan Piker makes his debut. We are, in fact, going to be talking about
tonight
Dave
at 7:30,
Rubin.
Barry Weiss will be here, and we're just going to have an opportunity where everybody's just going to get up and
just
remind try to make fun of her.
It's like Nando Vila just tweeted me a tweet of Steve Pinker quote tweeting Andrew Yang saying that we need to acknowledge that people's genetic predispositions influence their politics. And Steve Pinker was like something to the effect of, you know, oh, amazing to see a candidate acknowledging these genetic predispositions. And Nando was like, this is designed for @_Michael Brooks. And it's like, yes, to totally piss me off and remind me of how utterly fallen and messed up our world is and all of the people I truly don't like, including, I'm sorry, Andrew Yang. Meditation has not made me softer on Andrew Yang.
We have no tradition in this world where people focus on genetics.
Yeah, no, it's just totally
no tradition whatsoever.
It's totally gone.
I love that with everything going on, I'm going to have to learn about twin studies.
Now. And then I loved this is, and I also loved Adam H. Johnson's the sheer energy it takes for him to not openly come out as a race science advocate could power Las Vegas for decades. But anyways, this is all true and getting me back into the riff zone. And then Milton Alamadi, who is an amazing journalist, editor of Black Star News, is going to come in, and we're going to talk about Uganda, Libya, and a whole bunch of others that we have a huge amount to get to. So 7 p.m., we're back live tomorrow. For patrons, I just want to let people know that the second video illicit history has been released on the history of Medicaid and states' rights with Jamila Michener. And then also... the first one that was behind, they're going to be behind a paywall for a month for Comrade and Above patrons because they're what's making it possible to invest in it with Vic Viana. But after a month, we release it publicly on YouTube because we want it to be like early advantage for patrons, but then everybody watch these things. So that illicit history of Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition, I couldn't be more proud of. And it actually, I didn't actually know this, but Ryan Grimm has a new book out where he covers some of the same terrain in the modern history of the Democratic Party.
He's going to be on the show.
He's going to be on the show? Awesome.
Am I right? We have him? Don't we have him planned?
I'm sure. So, and then Bill Fletcher Jr. Bill Fletcher Jr. Is the featured person on this, and he worked on that campaign and was a strategist for the Rainbow and is brilliant. And so go check that out on YouTube, and also the illicit histories of Hezbollah and conversation on capitalist realism, patreon.com/TMBS, and see you tomorrow.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, remember when me and Sam got in an argument about where neoliberalism came from? And Sam thought it was mostly the result of bad people who had some bad ideas and enforced them. I thought it was largely overdetermined by a crisis of capitalist accumulation that continues to this day. Well, turns out we were both right. That's
so nice when that works out.
That's right. This week on... History is a Weapon, number 4. We have released part 2 of History is a Weapon on the 1970s, featuring Matt Chrisman of Chapo Trap House, wherein Matt and Sean finish their extended look into the 1970s by answering the questions, why did Carterism fall apart over its internal contradictions? Where have the politics of personal virtue taken us? Why was Reagan the man of the hour? And why was Clintonism his enduring achievement? How did neoliberalism become the economic consensus? And what the hell is happening now that its entire political and economic edifice is collapsing? All of this and more on part 2 of History is a Weapon, number 4, out now for our patrons, patreon.com/theantifada.
Do you know what Margaret Thatcher said? Maybe it's apocryphal, but they asked her what her greatest achievement was. She said Tony Blair.
That does not surprise me.
Damn. Those Brits got the humor, yeah. Speaking of Brits, on Literary Hangover for patrons, a second episode of Orweller's coming out. George Orwell's episode, Such Were the Joys, about his time at St. Cyprian's Preparatory School as a kid. It wasn't printed in his lifetime because it was too libelous. Indeed, there's a... Orwell commented to his publisher itself saying... unprintable, libelous until a bunch of people are dead. And what's funny about it is Orwell gets a lot of, everyone's like, oh, Saint Orwell, he always tells the truth. He lies about a lot of people, even like without changing their names, for a political purpose. He's trying to say that schools sending your kids miles and miles away leads to abuse, which it does, and we all know it does, but Orwell definitely exaggerated it and used real people's names to it. So it's kind of interesting. Orwell, the propagandist.
Orwell, the messy bitch.
All right, folks.
Definitely time to Patreon for that.
We take a quick break. Fun half, 646-257-3920.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you.
you're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.